Hi, and welcome to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, taping here at robertaspizza.com in Bushwick, Brooklyn, in their lovely backyard stevedore studio. Here today with kind of like the Mount Rushmore of graphic designers in New York in regards to the restaurant industry, Matteo Bologna, Douglas Riccardi, and Luis Feely. I'm just going to go off and tell you a little bit about their client list. Douglas has done Mary Batali's Molto Gusto cookbook, Italian Grill, Babbo cookbook, Molto Italiano, done the overall design, graphic menus, etc. for Pizzeria Mozza, Hale and Hearty Soup, Schnippers, even the dear to my heart and departed Florent. Matteo Bologna from Mucca Design pretty much has branded most of Keith McNally's empire, Balthazar Pastis. Morandi has also worked with Brooklyn Fair, the beautiful Chanterelle cookbook, which is one of my favorites in the last couple of years, and Japanese Brasserie, St. Ambrose, Andre Blaz's The Standard, and most of the Patina Group, which is a large restaurant group operated by Nick Valtini and Chef Joachim Splichal. Luis Feely is branded for Sarah Beth's, Irving Farm, Late July, Tate's, William Sonoma, American Spoon, helped rebrand Good Housekeeping, Tiffany & Co., done restaurants such as Foglia, Artisanal, Picholine, Mermaid Inn, The Harrison, Chiquito, Tocqueville, Porterhouse, Il Molino, just to name a few. So aside from that, it's almost easier to do this as a process of elimination show as to what you all have not designed. but we're going to start with actually what is graphic design, not as a necessarily overall umbrella statement, but what is graphic design relative to restaurants and food in New York? They're pointing at you, Louis.
I don't know why, but I'll try to answer the question.
Because you speak English.
Barely. Graphic design for food in particular is all about just making it appetizing. A lot of people don't realize that the first indicator you'll get of a restaurant, whether you're walking by the actual restaurant or looking on the website, is the logo. And the logo has to be appetizing. It has to give some kind of clue as to what is going on, or nobody's going to bother to go any further.
Yeah. That's what my cab driver told me when we arrived here at Roberta's, where he said, "Is this a restaurant? Are you sure it's the right place?"
So, I mean, even looking at Roberta's, driving up to here, what about it, you know, in your mind, would you have initially changed? What kind of concept behind the, you know, script? What did it make you think it was?
It's perfect.
It is yeah. Perfect.
It's like exact opposite of what Luis said.
Yeah.
But we're in Bushwick.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was giving the Manhattan version of...
Yeah, exactly. Because... Sorry.
I think a huge sign outside, neon and an awning, and everything that you would want to do in Manhattan would be 100% wrong here.
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, you do not see red. You do not see script. You do not even see a person's name if it's not N. Sons or Ann Co. in this area of Bushwick. So, yeah.
Maybe you should describe, too, how is the place outside?
Oh, you mean like gray Armageddon? I mean, it is...
the facade of the building.
Yeah,
it really doesn't look like a restaurant.
No, we call it's distressed, you know?
Yes.
But not distressed in the sense that we aren't having fun here. Having
but, you know, Florent always had this theory that if you want to open a successful restaurant, the last place you'd want to put it is on Park Avenue. If you say, "I went to a restaurant on Park Avenue," people are like, "I could care less." But if you say, "I went to a restaurant in Bushwick," all of a sudden people are like, "Hey, I got to try that because, you know, it's off the beaten track."
Yeah, yes. Or Madison Avenue,
exactly.
For that matter.
Wherever. That's why the meat market in 1985, when they opened, was so attractive because it was no one ever went there.
Yeah,
he was a pioneer. It was great.
And did you meet Florent when he opened up the restaurant?
A couple years later, actually.
Yeah, and... I mean, was it a draw for you? Did you go there to meet him and to, you know, eat at the restaurant? Or did you go to him because you thought he was an absolutely amazing and smart client?
I actually met him because he was a client of the place where I was working. So it was sort of a marriage, an arranged marriage. But no, I didn't actually seek him out.
Yeah, yeah. And what were some of the first clients that you guys had in New York?
Hmm.
I think Louise and I were talking that I think I win the longevity award because 1986 I was working at Emma Company and we did China Grill, which was, you know, the boom of the super uber restaurant design years in New York City, and China Grill 1986 was the first client I ever had.
Excellent. And what other restaurants at that time were part of that similar boom?
That whole...
Oh, God, they're all gone now.
Exactly. Odeon was... Is there actually still around?
Yeah, Odeon's still around. Right.
That might have actually predated even China Grill.
Yes, it did.
That whole slew of West Broadway, Soho places that were popping up, you know, it seems like every 5 minutes another one came and went.
Yeah. And Luis Mateo, what were some of your first restaurant clients in New York?
Well, my very first one was for a restaurant called Prefix, which then became the same client, but then it became a couple of other restaurants. He would get bored with one name and concept and go to another, but it was fine for me because I could keep redesigning the logos. So that became Flatiron Diner, and then it became Metropole, and then now it's Cupcake Cafe, which is fine. Yeah, and Matteo, yours was?
I moved in United States from Italy in 1994, and my first restaurant was Pravda, which was actually a bar restaurant.
Yeah, and Pravda is one of Keith McNally's restaurants.
Yes.
Right. And how did you initially hook up with him and then, you know, eventually design this whole empire?
I knew the au pair of his partner. And
seek,
they needed a graphic designer.
Yeah. Seek out those au pairs if you're a starving graphic designer in New York.
And so I got
a very rigorous selection process.
I got an interview with them. And thank God his partner was speaking, she's from Germany, and therefore her English was more similar to mine. I was able to understand what she was telling me. That's the truth. And Keith was speaking with me, and I couldn't understand a single word. I mean, my English, I just moved here and I didn't speak a word of English. And I really couldn't understand anything. I was just nodding and looking at her in her eyes, trying to hope that she would translate what he was saying. I don't know why I got the job.
So you may have misinterpreted Pravda, Balthazar, Pastis as other words,
yes,
and they just became infamous like this.
Yeah, I thought they were South African restaurants Mexican restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, so it's interesting that you say coming from Italy in 94, because I also was reading in, I believe it was Print Magazine's food issue last year, that Luis, you said a lot of your cooking is inspired by Italian. Do cooking and your backgrounds influence the way you design for specific restaurants?
I don't cook.
Yeah.
Sometimes,
but you're
Italian. Sometimes I follow recipes, but, you know, I was eating because my mother was cooking. That's it. I'm the terrible cook.
Yeah.
No, for me, it's very important. I came from a background of publishing. I was art director of Pantheon Books, and I did lots and lots and lots of book jackets, which I love doing. But after over a decade of doing that, I realized it was time to start my own studio so I could focus on my three passions. I'm a pretty quick study. Food, type, and Italy. So that's why it was great that I could find a way to do this with restaurants and then later in food packaging.
Yeah, and Douglas, do you have a cooking background? Do you have a...
I come from a very strong Italian-American family that, you know, spends 90% of its life worrying about what they're going to eat at their next meal. So it's only natural that 90% of my clients have the same sort of obsession.
Yeah. And I mean, a couple of you spawn outside of that Italian, you know, genre. I mean, there's and Brasserie for Matteo. And then, I mean, Tate's is UK based. And then Douglas, you may be right. You're almost 90% Italian. But Hale and Hearty Soup seems more like a
yeah, Schnippers is obviously not Italian at all.
Yeah. And how do you approach those clients that don't necessarily have that Italian ethnicity in their business?
I mean, the weird thing is, like, in America, people think that there is an Italian style.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to a restaurant in Italy, you'll start puke because of the style of the restaurant.
Yes.
I mean, the food is the most important thing. The look is usually pretty bad.
Yeah. I mean, how many restaurants in Italy actually have a logo?
Like two?
No.
Yeah,
no, exactly.
Yeah.
And if they do, you
shy away
from it. Suspicious.
Yeah. It's mainly just a street address and
right.
Yes. Or a guy outside hailing you.
I mean, lighting in restaurants in Italy is usually fluorescent.
Yeah.
Yes.
not and, very
and
sexy.
Always bad art on the walls.
Of course.
Right.
So, from their friend, the painter.
So what is different about American restaurants and logos and graphic design from the rest of the world?
Well, I once met someone in Paris who asked me what I did for a living, a Parisian, and when I tried to explain it, he couldn't understand, because they, you know, same thing in Paris, they, you know, there's never such thing really as a logo. It's just, you know, La Coupole, any of those restaurants, you just picture that beautiful script neon, which the neon sign maker made. So it's just sort of, it's just inherent. It's not a self-conscious act of design over there. But here, because it's all newer, we have to use graphic design to express what the restaurant stands for. And I think, you know, we were talking about in '86 when you first started doing your first restaurant, Douglas, and that period I think was a very exciting time, because that was when the public really started to pay attention to both graphic design and interior design for restaurants, and they were finally starting to notice it and even pay some money sometimes.
Sometimes. Very little.
More to the interior designers, I guess.
Yes.
But also, in the United States, we're obviously much more obsessed with going to the new places than they are in Paris. Like, in Paris, you go to the places that have been there the longest, and here you go to the places that have been here the yes. least amount of time. So obviously, to keep that whole engine going, you rely on, you know, people like us to make things look new and hip and, you know, enticing.
But at the same
time, not to say that we're pulling the wool over people's eyes,
yeah.
But
I mean, at the same time, both with McNally's restaurants and Batali's, also, you know, huge empire, there has to be consistency, and it can't just be, you know, a fleeting thing. It has to, you know, look archival, and that it's been there for a while and will be there for a long, long time.
But obviously, a celebrity chef-driven empire is slightly different than a non, because, you know, Mario's the best logo for all of his restaurants. I mean, he supersedes anything that anyone else can add to that. Mario and Joe, obviously.
Yeah.
But people that don't have that cachet have to rely on other, you know.
So rather than just dealing with a singular entity, how do you approach Mario's new restaurants, new books? What is that kind of a consistency that, you know, you adhere to his logo or to his graphic design?
I think that, you know, with he has a creative director that I've worked with for years. Her name is Lisa Eaton. And I sort of feel like he has a sort of Italian style that isn't really all that Italian, but it sort of melds a fictitious version of Italian with his larger-than-life, very bold, very colorful, very spontaneous character. And I think that for him, he's not like Keith McNally, who tries to do different things. Every one of his restaurants is Keith's, I think. I might be wrong, Mateo. Is much more different, related to different places or times or cuisines. Mario's is reinventions of a theme, so I think that his design stuff is all, you know, reinventing and trying to just keep it new for us.
Yeah,
does
and
that
then
make any sense at all?
Oh, no, definitely, because I mean, it's an interesting segue to talking to Mateo about how do you keep consistency over such varied, you know, types of restaurants, cuisine, and, you know, approach?
You know, we are designers, so at the end, I mean, there's not much. I mean, we are the filter.
Yeah.
I mean, the graphic designer is the filter between, you know, the client and the design that comes out. Of course, we have some tastes, some choices. Then. Go through us, and we like to do certain things, and therefore the outcome follows our client, and try to, of course, to stay as close to the client's brief, but then of course it goes through us.
Yeah.
You get a brief?
Yeah, sometimes.
I've never gotten a brief.
he's gotten briefs. Yeah. But so I mean that parlays into the idea of control. How much do you have?
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
You said none or
none?
Well, I find this. I try to stay with smaller clients, because I find the bigger the client, the less creative control you have. I mean, that's pretty obvious, I guess. But I'd much rather work with a small client, even if it means a lot less money. But at least we usually see eye to eye, and I also get a lot of satisfaction watching a small company grow and succeed, and hope that maybe it had something to do with the design.
I mean, what examples of small companies that you've worked with in the past that you've seen bloom, that you started, you know, their logo, their branding, and now they're just international.
Well, I guess late July. I did the original packaging for late July, and what you see in the store now is actually not done by us. But the original packaging was completely hand lettered, including the net weight, which is the way I like to do things. Yeah. But then we had the client and I had an amicable divorce because she wanted it to be more commercial, and now it's not all hand lettered. You can tell.
New great typefaces that you can find in. Really, in the best supermarket. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, indeed. They shout on demand.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean,
they have a lot of drop shadows.
Let's talk about type then. I mean, obviously, that is, would you say, one of the major parts of most logos, most graphic design, if not the ultimate, you know, tool that you guys can convey with. How has type changed over the last 20 years in New York and influenced the food industry?
Whoa.
Yeah, big question. I should have emailed that
one
before.
Well, actually, one thing I can say about type, and this is more text type, but it still is important, because of what we were talking about before with you know, what was happening in the mid-80s and restaurants were really changing, and I think another big change that happened then was that the menu, the actual physical menu, which up until then had a lot of constraints, you know, it both in terms of content and design. There wasn't a lot you could do with the menu because you had to send it out to the typesetter to have a typeset, and then you had to send it to the printer. So, of course, you couldn't change the menu ever, hardly.
And now with, you know, seasonal farm-to-table, they change it every day, if not every hour.
Except you can't actually design it because the manager has to make the changes, and they obviously didn't do 4 years of design school to their benefit.
So when are restaurants going to start having in-house graphic designers?
Actually, there's one of my client who used to be a graphic designer.
They got out.
And it's fantastic because it's N Brasserie. And we did the design for this friend of mine who's the owner, and she married the graphic designer who became her partner. And he took our design and he made it way better. And it's the only time it ever happened.
That's
to
amazing.
Us.
Yeah.
Because as a graphic designer, when you work for a restaurant, what you end up doing usually is you handle them a file, which is a template with all the last menu that they gave us, that they have ready. And then they change the type and the prices themselves. And usually it's never a graphic designer. Sometimes I receive phone calls from the managers asking me, how do you turn on the computer?
Usually the same button that you use, turn it off, right?
Yeah.
But we have a client, the person that does the menus at Mozza LA has this obsession, which is the biggest typographic no-no in the world, where they start with the longest entree and the last line is the shortest entree, so it's a perfect inverted triangle every time.
That's a
but
dream.
Like, you couldn't do it that perfectly if you tried, and as a typographer, you just cringe when you see that, but that's the way they love it, which is kind of fantastic.
Yeah. Is that because of attention span, possibly?
No, I think he just finds it really cool that he is able to make like an hourglass or like a triangle.
That's admirable.
Well, I mean, the pizzeria Mozza symbol too, I mean, looks sort of like a triangle pizza slice.
Sort of, yes, but maybe he was thinking about that, or she, I'm not even sure who does it, but I don't think it goes that far.
Yeah. And I mean, Luis, I kind of cut you off before when you were talking about the industrial changes over the last couple of years from, you know, having to deal with typesetters now to, you know, turning on a printer and it's Wi-Fi and it could be in the building next door and print it out and go.
Right. No, it's made a huge difference in menus because when it started to happen in the mid-80s, it was coinciding with all the seasonal ingredient rage. So that was perfect. But except for what we've said here about a file being a dangerous thing in the hands of a chef or a manager. But do you do your files in InDesign?
Of course.
Oh, now we're going to really bore them to death.
No. It's not
what version
boring.
Do you use?
What plugins do you have?
Actually, for Schiller's, which is a restaurant in the Lower East Side that needed to have a kind of a casual feeling, we thought about doing handwritten menu. But because of the reason that people keeps changing, I mean, personnel keeps changing, it's never the same person who's making the menu, it would have been a big problem. Also, because this is a Keith McNally restaurant, they have this habit of changing their menu every day.
Yeah.
So because I'm a nerd, I created a typeface that mimics scripts so that everybody would be able to use it freely, you know, from the maitre d' to the busboy. And because I'm a uber nerd, I realized that, you know, if you create a typeface that mimics scripts, when you have two letters next to each other, let's say Matteo, my name, that has two T's, the second T looks exactly like the first one, and then it doesn't look, it looks, start looking like if it's made with a computer. So we created a font that has variations of each letter, and when you type, you never have the same letter repeated more than once. So it's pretty nerdy. Awesome.
And yeah. Do they still use that menu?
Yeah, apparently, yes. Mm. I don't know. I haven't been there in a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, kids now. I don't go out.
I mean, first of all, whose handwriting did you base that off of? Did you get a check from Keith and say, I'm going to try to forge it?
It was an old menu from Rome.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to look like ballpoint pen.
Right? It was really disgusting.
Yeah.
Really horrendous handwriting, but fantastic at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, let's talk about inspiration, too, of some of your clients. Where has the logo, the type, the branding, where has it come from, aside from just meeting?
Our genius.
Yeah. It's just innate. It just exudes. But, I mean, have there been instances where you've taken one even food experience and then brought it back into a restaurant to help them design?
Usually we design before the restaurant is open.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult. Sometimes, you know, they're opening the restaurant and they don't even have the finished menu the day before.
Or the name.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I mean, you don't get to go in and experience it. You don't get to eat their food. You have to design before.
Yeah, sometimes, delicious. You know, you go to some tasting that they do, but it usually happens way after we started
working. And I don't think this is an industry that has the foresight that maybe others do, that actually sort of sends you their whole food and wine brief and experience. Yeah. And, you know, it doesn't seem like, at least in my personal experience, that it follows that logical path.
Yeah. Do you hope that it becomes that? Do you hope that there's
I don't think it ever will.
Yeah.
You know, I think cooking is much too sort of spontaneous, or maybe I'm totally wrong, but I think that's sort of what's nice about the restaurant industry, is that it changes from day to day. You could get a case of whatever ramps in one day, and all of a sudden your whole menu is ramp based.
Yeah. I mean, does that happen to you? Do you get a whole case of, you
know, we don't have to deal with the fact that they're changing
times
their whole
new
menu.
Roman in one day, and then everything's times new Roman for the rest of the week?
Not really.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
It's true.
Okay, write it
down. Yeah. So we're going to take a quick break, come back, maybe even, you know, point out Matteo's genius about if you can't hire him, marry him. But talk a little bit more about the restaurant industry and how graphic design may drive your taste buds more than you think. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back. And we're back. You're listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Matteo Bologna of Mucca Design, Douglas Riccardi of Memo, and Luis Fili of Louise Feely.
LTD.
Yeah, LTD. Yes. And memo is memo-ny.com.
Memo
Productions. Memo Productions.
And Mooka, is there a...
Mooka.com.
Yeah, just Mooka.com. Yeah. Mookadesign.com?
Yeah, it's Mookadesign.
Rolled in here with all his URLs, you know.
And Mooka means cow, so probably it's related to food.
Yeah. There we go. End of show. Headphones off. During the break, Douglas actually was talking about blackboards. We had just initially been talking about Schiller's and Matteo developing a script that looked like real script, and no two letters were the same when there was repeating, you know, consonants, vowels. But Douglas, tell us a little about Florence Guy Harry.
Well, actually, Harry didn't do the blackboards. He did the daily specials.
The daily specials.
We had another whole crew that did the nightly overnight blackboards, led by Tom Eubanks. And actually, they had three menus. Sorry, those push letter things. What do you call those? Felt boards.
Yeah.
That they used to change every night. And it was actually started as a way to keep the overnight staff occupied because they had so much time on their hands between like 3 and 4 a.m. And that sort of became part of the big branding of the restaurant. We had a font, a person make turn it into a font for us, sort of like the Schiller's, that we then used for 90% of the stuff that we did for Florent.
Yeah. And what was Harry's role?
Harry was the day manager.
Yeah. And Douglas was just saying, too, that Harry was, what, a cave...
Cave Queen was his self-imposed title. But actually, I was saying that he had such... fantastic lack of computer skills that when he did the daily specials, it had more personality than anything I could ever do, because he just sort of bolded wherever he wanted, tracked out wherever he wanted. Certain things were bigger, certain things were flesh right, and it was an absolute a wonderful piece of typography, totally you know, done without a designer's
a collector's item.
Exactly.
Also mentioning Karen Waltuck at Chanterelle, where Schiller's is supposed to replicate the idea of someone writing that every day. Karen Waltuck would write her own menu for 20 plus years, every handwritten day. Every single day. And it was a thing of beauty to kind of watch. And it reminded me of one time having been in, Masa restaurant. I didn't get to eat there. I got to photograph Masa once while he wrote out the day's menu. And after he was done, he showed it to his assistant, who typed it up on the computer, was given back the piece of paper, which was in beautiful script, and just destroyed it. You know, kind of like a cinnamon dollar, just wash it away. Mm-hmm. Has technology, has Illustrator, have computers changed the way that you guys design?
I think Luigi will answer to this question.
No, Matteo's being cruel. I don't use a computer. That's
what No, you use it.
Well, I...
For email.
Yeah,
for email.
I got an email.
I'm very old world. I still design logos the way I've always designed them. I sit down with a tracing pad and I just I just write.
Yes. I'm so
have you ever heard
envious.
Of a tracing pad?
No, not at all.
And I do the same. It's the same process I did when I used to do book covers. I would just sort of write the title of the book over and over again, and it would just sort of I would just let it speak to me, and it would turn into a logo basically. And that's why I do logos the same way. And then once I get to that point, then I have to figure out how to make that into an actual logo, and that's when I talk to my staff and direct them to do it. But it's never an existing font, of course, because that wouldn't be a logo. That's the number one rule of logos, is that you don't just set a word in a font.
Oh, boy.
Don't you?
Really?
Well, that's what I tell my students. Well,
that's the rule on this side of the room.
Exactly.
Sometimes, yeah, if it's depending on the restaurant.
Yeah, do you guys have rules, mantras on what, you know, constitutes a logo?
If you can sell it.
If you can sell it.
It's the fee.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If it's about the fee, yeah. Never go below a certain amount of dollars.
Going back to Luis, and actually drawing again from Schiller's, the Mermaid Inn logo seems, you know, very handmade, very, you know, hand-drawn, and doesn't, you know... edge on hard edges, doesn't edge on, you know,
right,
something that's monumentally aesthetic necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
What was the concept behind that?
Are we showing the slide right now?
What?
People are
showing
Googling
the slide?
They're Googling. Mermaid
in NYC. Yeah. Google.
Well, Jimmy Bradley and Danny Abrams were the owners of this restaurant. When they came to me to talk to me about it, they they gave me the best direction ever. They just said, we're opening this restaurant. We want it to feel like a little seafood shack that you would just stumble across while you're walking along the beach, except you happen to be in the East Village. So that was it. That told me what to do. I wanted something, you know, that had a certain funkiness to it, but still had some style. And, you know, we started with the image. I hired an illustrator, Anthony Russo, to do the mermaid. And I always feel very strongly that when you have an image with a logo, that the type in the image should be integrated, because that makes it much stronger.
She's all full of rules.
I do.
That's rule number two.
Watch out if you're working for me.
Exactly.
No wonder no one lasts very long working for me. And then for the Czech presenter, we wanted the whole concept to just be a little bit unusual. So I wanted to do something very unusual for the Czech presenter. So we ended up doing a sardine can that I personally had to empty out and scrub, so to get rid of the fishy smell. But the clients were still a little worried about that their customers may cut themselves on the sharp edges. So I personally painted the edges of every single can with clear nail polish.
So, I mean, this brings us from 2D to 3D. Like, the majority of what I always thought graphic design to be was, you know, on a computer, on a menu, in a cookbook. How often do you guys venture into the fabrication of certain things? Or how often are you involved in even dealing with interior designers initially?
Well, we actually still make things like menu covers.
Yeah.
Like, you have to deal with the bindery that's making the leather that then you stamp and then you fit the things in. There are certain elements that are just 2D.
Yeah.
And then there's menu boards in any place like Brooklyn Fair or Schnippers or any sort of more takeout-oriented or quick-service restaurant. There's a whole other host of in-store collateral pieces just to sort of communicate what you're selling to people.
Yeah.
So. Yes, or signs.
Exactly.
Street signs,
yes.
I mean, are
very important.
Big sculptures sometimes, mm-hmm. like in Schiller's.
Schiller's are
like
beautiful.
Yeah.
Humongous piece of type.
So
actually, we did for a hotel, the Chelsea Hotel in Atlantic City. It's the biggest type we ever made. It's like one letter was like 2 feet. It was on top of this skyscraper. It's fantastic. The biggest type ever designed and produced.
That's awesome.
With neon.
With neon.
Yeah. Aside from neon, I mean, how do you liaise that fabrication? I mean, what materials are being used and how do you make sure your vision is executed the way you want it to be executed?
You deal with the vendor. I mean, you do research of materials. You deal with the vendor. You look at options. You discuss with the client. And then you cross your fingers.
Yeah, and you also liaise with the architect.
Yes.
And also New York is pretty strict about, you know, regulations on every street. There's a big book somewhere of like what you're allowed to make on every single street. So oftentimes you don't even have much choice where you have to use Times Roman on the sign because the building standard is Times Roman, or, you know, you have a beautiful script and all of a sudden they're telling you you got to set it in Times Roman. There are these weird external constraints.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and you can only put up a banner if the pole is already there and all kinds of
awnings are a whole other, you know, mishigas.
Yeah,
because you need to use only a certain color. For instance, we had a brand that was the colors were like purple and green and gray. Sorry, and we had to use
maroon. Probably.
Green and maroon. Thank you very much. And we had to use green awnings.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when we worked on Metrozur and Grand Central Terminal, that was a real signage challenge because. Basically, everything I proposed, they turned down. And finally, they told me that you really can't adhere anything to anything in Grand Central Terminal, which is challenging when you're trying to put up a sign. So I suggested a hologram, but that didn't fly either. So finally, they just sneaked a sign in one night, and nobody said anything.
It's still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even, you know, Schnippers had really strict EDC environment, what's it called? Empire State Development Corporation standards for Times Square. And they actually ended up doing probably 10 times more signage than they ever would have because the neighborhood is trying to oversign things to bring the neighborhood up, apparently.
Interesting. So, I mean, let's talk about a restaurant that has one location, then expands into a larger franchise. how do you translate that to a new location? I mean, how do the two Schnipper locations in New York, or there are more than two, right?
There's one in the works, but there isn't one yet.
Yeah.
So I can't talk to Schnippers.
Let's talk about Hale and Hardy. That's how do they differ per location?
I think that for the first few, it's an evolution, and then it sort of gels in, it coalesces into the sort of rollout package. You know, the first Schnipper, the first Hale and Hardy was an entity, and then they hired an architect, Wayne Tourette, and myself to redo their interior design and their branding. And from there, you know, we sort of used the next couple to refine things like the menu boards, even the way the menu boards were fabricated to get them to be, you know, more cost effective. But after the fourth or fifth one, it sort of does become a thing where we're hardly even involved. They can open a new Hale and Hardy without, you know, calling us, because the whole thing is between the signage vendor and the printers. They can kind of do the whole thing themselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when that happens, how do you, like a chef, watch for consistency or watch for, you know, continuity of your, you know, initial idea?
Some clients see us as the guardians of their continuity. Some clients would rather that we didn't chime in from time to time, and there's a whole host of, you know, that there's a big spectrum between that. So sometimes you call up and say, I saw the new store, and it's just, you know, I hate what you did, and they appreciate it, or other times they're, you know, they just kind of,
yeah,
they take it to heart.
So I mean, do you have favorites? Do you have ideal clients that you want to work with? Let's not pick favorites. Let's say new restaurants or new food ideas that you're hoping to garner as new work. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is pitch yourself. That's go for it. Yeah.
Well, I was telling Douglas when we were coming here today that I've always wanted to redesign Garden of Eden, because I go there almost every day, and the logo is so disgusting. And the color is terrible. It's blue, which, you know, we all know is not a food color. There's another rule for you, but
yeah,
I think you'll all agree.
What about blueberries? Or blue raspberry, which isn't even a flavor.
They're weird. Yeah. They're not food.
And I actually, and I never do this, I actually got the name of the owner, and I sent him an email from the heart, and I just explained, you know, why I think he needs a better identity, because his identity doesn't really measure up to the quality of the store. And I sent a PDF with a lot of before and after examples, which usually helps convince clients. And he wrote me back right away, and then it sort of went nowhere after that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But, which is what usually happens.
Let's push that to the topic of best and worst logos. And you don't have to name your own, but around the city.
Schiller's is horrible.
Yeah.
actually, that
double L just irks me every time.
I think Luis can say something about the Baltazar logo.
Oh, that I wish I had a dime for every time someone asked me if I designed it?
No. The problems with that logo.
Oh, the problem. No, I don't see any problems with it. No, not at all.
You know, because I'm a nerd.
Yeah.
This is the stuff that only nerd sees. There's the distance between the L and the T, which is called kerning.
Yeah.
It's too tight.
Oh, yeah. I've always kind of been irked by that, too.
But he's learned.
I'm the angry man that walks by.
Can't you send him new artwork,
shaking my fist. Say, damn,
buy 100,000 new cups and print. Right,
there you go. Yeah. But you've learned, and now you get well paid for your kerning.
Yes. Now I'm a kerner.
Yeah,
a kerning nerd.
So what are some of your favorite logos around the city, or some logos that you walk by and just feel like are horrendous, but maybe, you know, stores, restaurants that are kicking butt?
Usually are the logos. I mean, I don't think there's any wrong logo. Maybe the logo could look bad or could look good. It depends on how it resonates to the customer. And Douglas is doing something behind my back. I don't know. He's writing something on a piece of paper, and they are all laughing, looking at me. I don't know.
What no, it's not about you.
Okay, that's good.
His fly is open.
So I think, you know, sometimes logos, I mean, the logo is not the identity of the restaurant. The logo is just the pinnacle. It's the thing that people eventually can remember, but what you actually remember is the service, the food, the ambiance, the menu, maybe the type on the menu, if it's legible or not. It's an ensemble of elements that are giving.
But don't you think, because it's the first thing you see, it's either an enticing or it's off-putting?
Yeah, it's not just that, because there's also a facade. It's attached to a facade, or maybe it's on a beautiful matchbox. You never know when you see the logo first. Maybe you see it on a bag.
True.
So the logo lives in a context always. It's never by itself. And I kind of don't believe in logos. I don't believe in logo as the vehicle of communicating the brand. The brand is an ensemble. It's like an orchestra. And you listen to music from the orchestra, not just from the conductor's name.
Yeah, I agree. A lot of clients come to me with terrible names for restaurants, and you know they're just not well thought out. And usually they just want to come up with a name in a big hurry. And they come up with some kind of default name, and they think that, oh, we'll just hand it over to the designer and that'll make it look good. That'll make it work, you know. But, you know, I feel that 90% of my job most of the time is trying to make an unpronounceable name look pronounceable.
Yeah.
And I think worse than a bad logo is what often happens, where you meet with someone and you give them a proposal that takes you a lot of time to write, and then they say thank you and never call you back, and then they just pick copperplate. It's usually copperplate that then they put on the window in vinyl or gold leaf, and they call it a logo. That irks me more than actually someone who designs a bad logo, which is just looking through a type book or calling the sign guy and asking them just to put a name up.
Or trying to copy one of our logos.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, that's good. There's a lot of restaurants that we did with Kit McNally, sometimes we ended up designing proposals for names that never happened.
Yeah.
So.
Such as what?
I don't know. I think Schiller's before was called Kaminsky.
Oh.
And then it was called, for one day, thank God, because they changed the name the day after, Alcohol, with a K. And thank God they changed their mind right after, and they called it Schiller's Liqueur Bar. And I worked on, you know, we work hard to make a logo look good based on the letters that they give you to the name of the place. And so when we did Morandi, because I had this experience with Schiller's, I said to the client that I wouldn't design the logo. I would just design a typeface. And then, however the name of the logo is, because of course we start, and now it's called Morandi, but there were like 10 names before. And I said, okay, I'm not going to design it. I'm just going to design a typeface that is yours. It's like unique. And however you want to change the name is going to be used by typing this custom typeface.
Which is true, because I know Louise would agree that you do often, more often than you'd think, someone says, I love the logo that you presented, it's just that we're now going to change the name. As if you can just swap out one name for the next, and it doesn't change anything. In their mind, it's just a matter of, you know, so I think you did solve that problem once and for all.
I mean, how often are you making just custom typefaces now and letting other, you know, people design the logo?
Usually we design custom typefaces for our clients, and sometimes we use this typeface for the logo, and sometimes we realize the typeface doesn't work for the logo, so we wasted a lot of time.
Yeah. I actually have no expertise in custom typefaces, so we customize typefaces. I know that breaks Louise's first law of logo design.
No, that's okay.
Is that okay?
Do something to it, yes.
Excellent. What's kind of interesting is that, you know, it's all type. It's not much image that we've spoken of so far. Mm-hmm. Is there ever image forward, type second, when you guys design?
I don't like images.
Yeah.
I hate photographers.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Oh, yes.
Thankfully, I'm a radio host.
Yeah, they're terrible.
Well, sometimes I think an image might be necessary when it's a difficult name or an unpronounceable name to give people a little visual mnemonic. Like when we did Picholine years ago, it actually started out being purely typographic. But that name was a problem. People couldn't pronounce it. They couldn't remember it. They couldn't spell it. And this was pre-Google. So, you know, the only chance was to try to call directory assistance and, you know, try to get a semblance of that name. So the original logo was just the type in a lozenge shape in olive green. So maybe it might reflect an olive, maybe, because Picholine is a type of an
thank
olive.
Thank you very much.
And after I designed the logo, I found a jar of them in the back of my refrigerator. I didn't even realize it. But then after they got their third star and they wanted to upgrade everything, we added an olive branch to it just to help people along a little bit more. So sometimes it's necessary.
Yeah. But the majority are still type.
And well, if you think of restaurant branding as a subset of the big world of branding, I mean, the big world of branding seems to rely more on non-typographic logos, whereas restaurants sort of never do that.
Yeah.
Maybe Starbucks, maybe the mermaid weirdness is more important than the actual type, but I'm not even so sure.
So would you ever do like in structure art or like a picture art menu or logo where people can just point to the dishes and point to the elements of dishes?
I love that idea.
Yeah, yeah. 10% right here.
Why not?
Yeah.
If
yeah,
it works, if they serve the purpose, why not?
Yeah.
Yes.
But let's end the show with what do we want to eliminate as far as having clients bring to you information for graphic design. I'm hearing one, really hard to pronounce and absurd names. Are there specific elements? Are there like Z's or double K's? Or, you know, is there combinations of letters or ways things are spelled out that you think should not be a part of graphic design? Or typefaces, kind of like a copper plate?
Definitely copperplate needs to be.
Was that Pulino's?
No, I don't know.
No, I thought Pulino's was copperplate.
No, I think it's Arial.
Oh.
Oh, now that's class. Yes.
Yes, very classy.
Now,
there's something that kind of puzzles me, and I have a lot of Italian restaurateurs, clients, and they always want to put the names in the menus in Italian, the name of the products of the dishes in Italian, and sometimes with the Italian description, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, we are in America. And they don't get it. They think it's cool. I don't know. I understand. Maybe it's a question I have to ask you. I mean, how do you feel when you see these menus?
Well, I can read them, but I remember at Peasant, they used to have this huge menu. It was like 11 by 17. It's really small type. And it was all in Italian. And then the waiter would have to come and translate the entire thing standing there. Yeah. And then, of course, by the time he got to the bottom, everybody forgot what he said at the beginning. So I think it's bilingual now. I like seeing it in Italian. There's one restaurant, Enoteca, where they bring you a glossary, which I think is maybe a little precious. But
what I hate is when the servers can't pronounce the things that are on the menu in a different language. That just is the absolute worst.
Yeah.
They Gnocchi. Should all be fire.
Yeah.
And they say it with such authority, too.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate all this insight. I'm telling you, this is the Mount Rushmore of graphic design right here. Matteo Bologna of Mucha.
Thank you very much.
Douglas Riccardi of Memo.
Thank you.
Luis Fili of Luis Fili LTD.
Thank you.
And we also have Franz Huber here. Just a shout out to him for introducing initially to Douglas and the idea of this show. But if you guys are ever going to open up a restaurant, make sure to talk
to
Matteo.
Call
Matteo. Yeah,
Douglas.
Call Matteo. He'll give you everybody else's number.
10% off of his fee.
Yeah. You've been listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in Tuesdays, 3 p.m. Shout out to Jack Inslee for producing, Nat Wiener for engineer, and Fairway for sponsoring. Hope to have you back here again next week. Cheers.